It is Thursday, January 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Human Rights Watch calls on leaders to fight back against authoritarianism. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley discusses North Korea with VOA.
We have to make sure that they're about action and that that action is to completely stop all the nuclear activity that they're doing.
And we look at the risk and rewards of changing careers. It's all ahead. Human Rights Watch has released its annual report for 2018 and called on political leaders to fight what the group calls authoritarian populist agendas. Kenneth Roth is executive director of Human Rights Watch, and he spoke in Paris with the Associated Press.
This is a very dangerous time for human rights because the rise of the populists does pose an enormous threat. They've undercut some of our traditional supporters of human rights, like the United States, but they've also really encouraged strong men around the world to claim to speak for the majority and in the process to demonize minorities and to undermine their rights. So there's a serious threat out there. But what we've seen over the last year is that there's also serious resistance to this agenda of hate and intolerance. And that where that resistance has emerged strongly, we've been able to limit the damage done by the populists. And so for me, it's very important to engage, to continue to fight back against this populist surge, because we've seen that that kind of engagement and resistance can make a big difference and can salvage rights where they're at risk.
Roth describes why he thinks populists appeal to voters who elected them.
The rise of the populists was very much a response to genuine grievances that people had. They felt left behind economically. They were complaining about economic inequality. Many people disliked the cultural shifts associated with migration. Some people feared terrorism. And what the authoritarian populists did is take these legitimate grievances and scapegoat vulnerable minorities to say, you know, it's the migrants who are at fault. It's the asylum seekers. It's the refugees. And that effort to sort of blame a vulnerable minority for the problems of the majority has epitomized the rise of the populists.
Roth speaks about the administration of President Donald Trump.
Trump, in many ways, has been a disaster for human rights. Domestically, he's broken all the taboos against racism, against misogyny, against xenophobia. In his foreign policy, he has this insatiable admiration for strongmen. And so he embraces people like Putin or Erdogan, Sisi or Duterte. And of course, this makes it much more difficult to stigmatize these authoritarian leaders when Trump says, these are great guys. So what's really needed is for other governments to step into the breach. The British are gone because they're preoccupied with Brexit. They've really stopped playing an active role promoting human rights. And that's why we need countries like France and Germany coming to the fore. Sometimes they have, sometimes they haven't.
The White House repeatedly has pointed out that President Trump was elected on a pledge to reduce migration. He has denied holding racist views. Roth accuses authoritarian populists of seeking to replace democratically elected government by limiting rights and the rule of law with what he views as their self-serving interpretation of what the majority desires. He speaks about media freedom.
I think we have to be very careful about how do you confront actual propaganda, how do you confront actual fake news, because it's very dangerous for governments to get into the censorship business. When governments start telling us what's true and what's fake news, that's a recipe for censorship. You can imagine how that's going to be abused. And it's much more important to find tools to meet fake news with real news, or to perhaps undermine some of the economic incentives that the purveyors of fake news use. But we should be very careful not to use the fake news phenomenon as an excuse for governments to get into the censorship business.
Kenneth Roth, executive director of Human Rights Watch. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's trending?
Well, very timely, that report that you just aired, taking a look at human rights and, of course, a fundamental component of that, is the internationally agreed upon is the right free expression and the right of free press. And of course, yesterday I wanted to follow up a little bit. We had a maybe some people thought it was humorous. The president was getting ready to unveil his fakies, his fake news awards, and he did so yesterday. Well, he did so kind of. He took to the internet, and within about a minute or so of being on the internet, the entire website crashed. So nobody really got to see any of the awards. There were 10 awards, as he calls them, that were issued in all. CNN got 4 of them, the New York Times 2, various others. And of course, these were really not, in some cases, they were specific reports. In some cases, they were just perhaps like the last one, that the claims of Trump campaign collusion with Russia were fake, were phony. There's no collusion, as he's been repeating again and again. Well, regardless, today people are following up. But I'd mentioned yesterday, a lot of the Trump supporters were having a lot of fun with this hashtag fake news or hashtag fake news awards. They were looking forward to the event. They were, you know, taking their pot shots at the media, which is fine. I mean, you know, people in the media are big boys and girls. They're used to criticism. That's part of the job. Today, it's very different in tone. The tone is, I'm just going to start reading through a couple comments here. And this is really, I think, a somewhat representative sample. Wajahat Ali, who's a opinion writer, here in the United States. We laughed about the fake news awards, but it is quite, in fact, terrifying and chilling. This is what happens in dictatorships and fascist regimes. Facts, language, truth, and ultimately the press become hijacked to serve power. Let's see. Here was Scott Dworkin, again, also a he's a contributor on various cable programs. Fake news awards is one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen a president do. Not only is he attacking the free press, he's trying to make a joke out of him doing so. They're tasteless, classless, and dangerous. The ACLU has their own, the list of their own, the list of attacks by President Trump against the First Amendment. So interesting. I just think, you know, on any given day, you know, sometimes a story maybe has a sort of a lighthearted air. Mm-hmm. And in other days, you know, people really get themselves upset. And it seems, you know, people have really gotten quite upset about this whole fake news. I hate that expression, but there it is. Discussion.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Doug. That's social media editor, Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Turkey votes to extend its state of emergency. The Pope forcefully defends a Chilean bishop who's accused of covering up a priest's sexual abuse of children. The United States rejects accusations of being behind an Islamic State emergence in Afghanistan. And President Donald Trump and U.S. lawmakers are facing a government shutdown. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists have found that junk food might be affecting our immune system's ability to fight disease. Detailing their findings in a new study that will be published by the journal Cell, the researchers led by the University of Bonn found that our body's defense system reacts the same way to high-calorie foods packed with fats as it does to bacterial infections. In other words, whenever we eat a diet of these unhealthy foods, our immune systems think it's fighting off a disease. The study found that the behavior of the immune system remains quite active even after an individual switches to a more healthy diet. The researchers say the long-term changes to the immune system may be involved in increasing the risk for arteriosclerosis, the hardening and thickening of arteries, as well as diabetes and other diseases that have been linked to Western diets. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new U.S. fitness fad claims to burn fat all day long. President Donald Trump has accused Russia of helping North Korea evade international sanctions and said Pyongyang is making daily progress in its quest to develop ballistic missiles that can reach the United States. During the nearly hour-long interview with Reuters, Trump welcomed news of inter-Korean cooperation on the upcoming Winter Olympic Games to be held in the South next month, saying it could be an initial phase in helping diffuse tensions on the Korean Peninsula. VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren was in New York Wednesday, where she talked about North Korea with U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
Ambassador, I want to first talk about North Korea. The news is that North Korea, DPRK, and South Korea are going to walk together at the Olympics under that one flag. Your thoughts about that?
I think it's good that North Korea and South Korea are talking, but we shouldn't be misled by the fact that just because they've had talks about the Olympics and this is going to happen, that that's going to take away the dangerous side of North Korea. Until they actually stop the ballistic missile testing, until they actually show that they are willing to denuclearize, we have to be very careful. They've done these talks before. That's what stalled it for all these years. We have to make sure that they're about action and that that action is to completely stop all the nuclear activity that they're doing.
Well, apparently it's even going a little further that there's going to be a hockey team jointly between North Korea and South Korea.
I think that's fine. I think if they want to do that, that's fine. But it doesn't stop the international pressure from everyone that is telling North Korea to stop. So, you know, they can go and have those regional cooperation on that level, but at the end of the day, we still have nuclear missiles in North Korea that they continue to test and they continue to threaten the United States and the world with. And so we're going to keep that at the forefront.
Do you think that this is sort of a divide and conquer, and this is sort of some motive behind Kim Jong-un? It's not just that he has an interest in the Olympics and sort of unification of the peninsula, that there is some sort of message to the U.S.?
I think this is a distraction. I think this is doing what North Korea has always done, which is when things get hot, start talking. But the problem is we're not going to play the same game we've always played. We're not going to just talk and think that they've suddenly seen the, you know, seen their ways and seen the way out. They have to tell us they're going to stop with the testing. We have to see that the testing actually stops, and then we have to know that they're going to eliminate the program.
Or else. I mean, if they don't. I mean, we've had agreements before with North Korea.
Right.
That they have cheated on. We've got a situation where they, you know, they've managed to sort of navigate around sanctions. They've had some countries that have penetrated sanctions. What is the or else? I mean, if they, you know, I heard President Obama say we're not going to let North Korea become a nuclear nation. I've heard people in the current president's administration say that they are a nuclear nation. They've got a nuclear weapon. They just haven't figured out how to deliver it. So where are we on this?
But we're not comfortable with them being a nuclear nation, and we never will.
So what do we do?
We've seen the reckless.
So what do we do?
Look, just because North and South Korea are holding hands today doesn't mean that that threat has gone away. The United States and the international community is going to keep up the pressure on North Korea to totally disband. Until that time, we're going to wait and make sure there's no activity, no testing. But when that time comes, we will decide at that point. But all the cards are actually in North Korea's hands on how we respond. So if they do the right thing, we're happy to work with them. If they don't, we've got options on the table.
It's interesting, I think, for the first time, correct me if I'm wrong, you were actually able, or the United States, and you're the ambassador to the UN here, to get China and Russia to go with sanctions on North Korea. How did that come about?
You know, we've done three resolutions now, and I think it was the largest sanctions bill that had ever been on a country. And I think that what we had to do was show the threat and show that the threat was real. And then also show that the fact that North Korea would not be doing this ballistic missile testing if they didn't have the money to do it. They're not using revenue to feed their people. They're using the revenue to build the weapons to do these tests. And so what we said was we've got to cut off the revenue stream. And so now you see 90% of the trade's been cut off, over a third of the oil's been cut off, multiple trade issues have stopped, investments have stopped. But it's all about making sure they don't have enough money to continue the nuclear program.
So you think Kim Jong-un is just going to say, okay, we don't have any money, so we're going to stop?
We don't know what he's going to do. But we can't be okay with just saying, you know, he's never going to go there. I mean, this is a real threat to the United States, so we have to take it seriously. We have to keep the pressure on. There's no relaxing from the United States standpoint.
What about the false alarm? We've had we had the one in Hawaii just recently, and now Japan. And, you know, what's the United States going to you know, what are we going to do to combat that? We can't keep sending false alarms out to people.
I think it's terrifying. I mean, it's absolutely terrifying for the people on the ground that get those. But I also think that the administration is going to do everything they can to make sure all of that is in place and working properly. And those are the things that we have to continue to check up on and continue to make sure they don't happen.
VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren in an interview with U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley. Well, wearable technology is finding its way into many workouts. The thinking is that constantly monitoring their body can help people get the most out of their time at the gym. That's the idea behind Orange Theory, the newest U.S. fitness fad. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
Fairly normal day at the gym. You've got your over-enthusiastic trainer, rowing machines, treadmills, all the things that make up a high-intensity workout. What makes Orange Theory different is this heart monitor.
We focus on five-zone heart rate training, so we coach you throughout a one-hour class to the different zones of your heart, comprised of 30 minutes of cardio and 30 minutes of full-body resistance training, all done with a personal coach.
So, there's all the usual stuff. The Orange Theory twist? Work out hard enough to get your metabolism into the orange zone, up on the board.
Our theory behind Orange Theory is what we call the afterburn, trying to get your heart up into the metabolic state for 12 or more minutes in the one-hour class. And if you can accomplish that, you can burn an average of 900 calories throughout the entire workout and then into the next 24 to 36 hours.
There's not a whole lot of science to support the idea that there's anything special about the Orange Theory, but people who follow it say it's a fun and interesting way to stay fit.
Every time I come 4 days a week. It's a different class. It's never the same thing. I mean, you're always on the treadmill, the rower, and your exercise, but it's always different how it's split up, so it doesn't get boring.
And doctors point out that whether it's Orange Theory or CrossFit, so-called high-intensity training has all kinds of positive effects.
If you have high cholesterol, it's going to help you achieve a lower level of cholesterol with exercise as well. There are many benefits, including prevention in terms of cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer. These are all things that can that benefit from these high-intensity interval trainings.
Orange Theory has been around less than 10 years, but has expanded to more than 450 locations. Monthly memberships range from $60 to $160 a month. Individual classes are between $12 and $14 each. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. In Frederick, Maryland, Wheeler Stone, who's known by Doc Stone, is living his dream. He's creating leather costumes and accessories for people who love to dress up as fictional characters from movies. He's also designing and making various leather products for everyday life. As Faiza Al-Masri tells us, thanks to the internet, Stone's authentic handmade pieces find a growing market. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Doc Stone can spend hours working in his studio without getting tired or bored. For him, leatherworking is more of a hobby than a job.
I get to make something different every day. I get to create something from my brain, pattern it, and then create it, and suddenly it actually exists. So that's really the best.
Around 3 years ago, Stone quit his job as an emergency room nurse to become a maker.
The biggest thing about life is you can fail doing something that you don't enjoy. So why not risk succeeding at something that you do enjoy?
Giving up his job security was a calculated risk he was willing to take.
You know, there's always that moment where you're like, okay, can I pay the rent this month? You know, but I found that everything works out. You know, it like that last minute commission will come through, you know. I think with any kind of entrepreneurship, it's a risk.
Becoming a full-time maker gave Stone the chance to express his passion for what's called steampunk.
It is a alternative futurism. It is a retro Victorian reality that if you had seen the rise of steam-powered and brass and that kind of aesthetic instead of the more industrial gas-powered engine thing where it's more gritty and more versus like really inventive gauges and interesting things like that.
Steampunk performer Inger Talbot dresses as Xena, the fictional character that first appeared in the 1990s on the TV show Xena Warrior Princess.
What's appealing to me about it is there's no limits to it. There really is. You can take anything and you can steampunk it. It's, you know, an alternate time that never will be, never was. It's, you know, Victorian gone crazy.
She puts on her Xena armor when she attends steampunk festivals and events. Artist Stone helped customize her look by adding new pieces.
That is actually a sheath for my sword so that I can be walking around and have it on my back as opposed to carrying it around and, you know, possibly impaling people because I'm really, really bad about swinging it around when it's in my hands.
Steampunk or contemporary, the process of leather making is basically the same.
It all comes out on paper first. I draw it, you know, it comes in and I work out the details on paper. I go from there to actual paper patterning. I take, you know, a piece of paper, cut it out, pattern it around that and make sure that all the folds work, you know. And then from there you go and you cut leather and dye the leather and then sew it and then put it all together.
Stone prides himself on being a completely self-taught artist. Recently, he launched an online retail store where he sells various high-end handmade products.
I have a 3D printer, I have a computer. Actually, you know, there are leather artists who use lasers to cut out their stuff. So I think if anything, it's about integrating. It's just a tool. You know, computers are tools. And just as the same as my sewing machine. But it would still be me throwing the finishing touches on.
Leather artisan Doc Stone says that's what gives his products a distinctive spirit and personality. And gives him the pleasure he couldn't find at any job other than maker. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The resignation in November of President Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe has opened a window of opportunity for the long-suffering Zimbabwean people. The nearly four decades-long rule by Mugabe was marked by economic devastation, violence, disregard for the rule of law, and contempt for fundamental human rights. In 2001, the United States began imposing targeted measures against the government of Zimbabwe, including financial sanctions against selected individuals and entities, a ban on transfers of defense items and services, and a suspension of non-humanitarian government-to-government assistance. Nevertheless, as U.S. Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Stephanie Sullivan noted recently in testimony before Congress, the United States has maintained a strong relationship with the Zimbabwean people. Since Zimbabwe's independence in 1980, the United States has provided significant development assistance in the areas of health, food security, education, and economic opportunity for Zimbabwe citizens, though none of the U.S. foreign assistance now involves direct funding to the government. Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Sullivan said the change in Zimbabwe's government offers an opportunity for reform that could allow the United States to engage in ways we have not recently been able to do. That means, she emphasized, that current President Emmerson Mnangagwa must demonstrate his commitment to a democratic, just, healthy, and prosperous Zimbabwe. The U.S. policy for expanded engagement requires a focus on constitutional democracy, free and fair elections, respect for human rights and the rule of law, and an improved trade and investment climate. The country has a strong civil society and an experienced political opposition whose voices must count in charting a path forward, Ms. Sullivan said. The military needs to return to its barracks, and state institutions should be demilitarized. Perpetrators of abuses against civilians should be held accountable, regardless of party affiliation. And the government must engage in hard economic reform, including addressing budget deficits and reducing corruption. If President Mnangagwa wants improved diplomatic relations and access to international assistance and cooperation, particularly with the United States, his government must first implement reforms, declared Acting Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Sullivan. The United States stands ready to help the government and the people of Zimbabwe to achieve these goals. Fundamentally, this will be about the people of Zimbabwe, she added. We want to support their aspirations for a country that can reach its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.